This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest poet has just been named 14th Poet Laureate of the United States. And Donald Hall is here with an opening poem.
White Apples. When my father had been dead a week, I woke with his voice in my ear. I sat up in bed and held my breath and stared at the pale closed door. White apples and the taste of stone. If he called again, I would put on my coat and galoshes.
The voice of Donald Hall. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I'm holding his new book, Selected Poems, 1946 to 2006. And that title poem is so perfect because you say you write of life, death, and New Hampshire, right?
Right.
And it's all there in a few lines. And so is this book. Donald, when you hold this book, which represents 60 years of writing more, what do you think? What do you feel about this book?
Oh, I'm proud of it. But at the same time, I wonder whether I made all the right choices, both in and out. Still, but by and large, I'm pleased with it, and I'm glad to get a chance to read aloud from it.
Thank you. It's so good to have all of these poems together. I mean, that's the key thing.
Yes.
Because you have written piles of books. But
oh,
here
yes.
We can have this compendium, and we can just scan your life. You know, actually, what I wish they had done, Donald, I wish they had put the dates of each book in the table of contents. Because
yes.
Even though I had to, my memory isn't what it used to be. And I had to search my memory for that. That would have been the next edition, they should do that. Don't
well,
you agree?
I don't print them book by book necessarily. Some books are spread over different sections.
Well, that may be why.
And I make a series of new books. But I could have put the dates, approximate dates for every section.
Because they were chronological.
They are basically chronological.
Mm-hmm. Donald Hall is talking. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. And all the rest was rehearsal for this 1 minute. I'm so happy about it.
Well, thank you.
Donald Hall was born in New Haven, Connecticut. And he's the only child of Donald and Lucy Wells Hall, graduate of Phillips Exeter Academy. He received his bachelor's degree from Harvard. And a B.Lit, would that be a Bachelor of Literature?
Yes.
From Oxford. Donald Hall published his first poem at age 16.
Yes.
Do you remember that poem?
No, I can't remember it. I remember what one was about.
What was it about?
It was New Hampshire. It was about scythe mowing, the ways to mow with a scythe.
A topic you have folded into other poems.
Yes.
And who published that poem?
That came out in a little magazine from a small town in New York. The magazine was called Trails, and it specialized in rural poetry.
Well, the distinctions just came easily after that, age 16 to present day. And we're going to hear another poem from your life.
Let me read one that I wrote when I was 25 years old. When my first child was born, it's easy to remember the date of the child and by his birthdays and the date of the poem necessarily, because I wrote it just after he was born, 52 years ago. It's called My Son, My Executioner. My son, my executioner, I take you in my arms, quiet and small and just a stir, and whom my body warms. Sweet death, small son, our instrument of immortality, your cries and hungers document our bodily decay. We, 25 and 22, who seemed to live forever, observe enduring life in you and start to die together.
I was talking about that poem to the poet Merrill Loeffler yesterday.
Really?
He said it was written right before his first son was born. So I think Merrill had a communication with you. Everyone has had a communication with you over the
Just
years.
Just about.
Yeah. So Donald Hall is here at the Library of Congress. He is our new poet laureate. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we are going to hear poems from White Apples and the Taste of Stone, selected poems. At Harvard, Donald was editor for the Harvard Advocate. And at Oxford, the Oxford Poetry Society's Journal. So that brought you into an editorship early on.
Yes.
Where you were with the Paris Review.
Yes, I was poetry editor for the Paris Review for the first 9 years of its existence. And I got to know a lot of poets of my own generation that way. Because when I read them in other magazines and admired their work, I wrote to recruit them for the Paris Review. I remember one day when I wrote letters to James Wright and Louis Simpson on the same day, and both sent me poems, and both began friendships as well.
As well as Ezra Pound.
With Ezra Pound, I did an interview for the Paris Review.
And T.S. Eliot.
As I did with T.S. Eliot.
Marianne Moore, you've written
and
about.
And Marianne Moore as well.
What was that like to sit with T.S. Eliot?
Well, by the time I interviewed him, I knew him a little, so it wasn't terrifying. When I first met him in his London offices, I was going up to Oxford and right after Harvard, and he had asked me in a visit at Harvard to come and see him. That was absolutely terrifying because he was the king of the mountain in the way that no one since has been the king of the mountain.
Isn't that true?
And I met him and I was, so deferential. I must have been disgusting. But he knew what I was going through and he was perfectly kind. And as I was leaving, he said, lingering in the doorway, "Let me see. 40 years ago, I went from Harvard to Oxford. Now you are going from Harvard to Oxford. What advice may I give you?" And he waited just a millisecond and then said, "Do you have any long underwear?" I didn't even know it was funny at the time he told me. But I bought long underwear on the way back to the hotel.
From coming from him who was so unbending, though, it's pretty funny.
He wasn't really very unbending in private conversation with me.
Hmm. Well, I love his work.
Yes, me too.
I know you do. Donald Hall is here. I love his work. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're going to hear another poem.
This is a poem called "The Man in the Dead Machine." And when I say it, I have to identify the dead machine when you're just going to hear it. It's in the second line. It's a Grumman Hellcat, a fighter plane that fought on the American side in the Pacific War. The Man in the Dead Machine. High on a slope in New Guinea, the Grumman Hellcat lodges among bright vines as thick as arms. In 1943, the clenched hand of a pilot glided it here, where no one has ever been. In the cockpit, the helmeted skeleton sits upright, held by dry sinews at neck and shoulder, and by webbing that straps the pelvic cross to the cracked leather of the seat, and the breastbone to the canvas cover of the parachute. Or say that the shrapnel missed me, I flew back to the carrier, and every morning take the train, my pale hands on a black case, and sit upright, held by the firm webbing.
Donald Hall, I was looking at the selection of poems on your CD, and as I say, I just discovered that it was in the back of the book. So that proves I bought the book, not did get it from the library. And I listened to them all at once. It took about an hour, I think. And I was taken by the poems I think might be your touchstone poems. I thought to myself, he chose these poems for the CD because they are poems he wouldn't want to live without. Am I making that too dramatic?
No, that's pretty true, and they're the ones that I like to read in particular. There are a few favorite poems that I don't like to read aloud, but for the most part I write for the ear or the mouth, and I chose poems which definitely could be represented by the mouth.
You say words were meant to say.
Yeah.
You say that in one of your essays.
Uh-huh.
Right. But the interesting thing about listening to it all from your early days is that I think your tone in the poems has not really changed that much.
Really? That's hard for me to see.
I interviewed David Wagoner last week. Do you know David?
Yes, a little.
He's good. He felt that his poetry from the beginning was very different from his poems today. I mean, he says, I mean, they really are. They were, and even when you look at James Dickey, how formal he was in the beginning and heroic, and then how down home he got. But I feel that you knew who you were early on. You were very centered in your spirit in the beginning. And although the poems have changed and your mood has changed and your anger
has
changed.
The poems have become a lot more naked.
That's,
over the years.
I believe that, but I think the tone of voice is a lot the same.
Again, that's very hard for the poet himself to see.
Well, that's why it's good to have it all in one book.
Yes.
I think. Donald Hall is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. It is High Holiday in every language if we hear another poem.
This is a poem called Gold. Pale gold of the walls, gold of the centers of daisies, yellow roses pressing from a clear bowl. All day we lay on the bed, my hand stroking the deep gold of your thighs and your back. We slept and woke, entering the golden room together, lay down in it breathing quickly, then slowly again, caressing and dozing, your hand sleepily touching my hair now. We made in those days tiny identical rooms inside our bodies, which the men who uncover our graves will find in 1,000 years, shining and whole.
Donald Hall taught at the University of Michigan, and there he met Jane Kenyon, and they married in 1972 and moved to a place he always wanted to live, Eagles Pond, his grandparents' farm, 140 acres.
Yes.
Lived there for 23 years of marriage with Jane until she died in 1995 of leukemia.
Yeah.
The important thing that has come out of this book for me is that nobody really belongs to us except in memory. I mean, nobody really belongs to us except in memory,
no.
Right? I mean, there's a poem by Josephine Jacobson watching her husband sleeping and she knows she doesn't own him.
Yeah.
But we couldn't enter your life with Jane. We couldn't walk by the pond with Gus. We couldn't sleep in the painted bed. But because of these poems, you have created a spiritual reality where we can enter.
Yes, probably especially in the poems that were letters to Jane.
But that is a sacred thing. You have created an alternate universe where we can enter your life, where we could not have really entered your life.
So, I was creating it for myself in her absence, you know.
I do know that. But look what you have given us. It is a holy dimension that we can enter. And so these poems, they call elegiac. I mean, do you know any poet who's not elegiac?
Virtually not.
No, I don't know any either. But these poems that come from 95 on certainly are. And we're very, very proud and happy that you allow your vulnerability to be in our hands. You have an essay that says vulnerability is the opposite of sentimentality.
Do I?
Yes.
Yes.
It's the truth.
Good. I agree with it sounding it. I don't remember saying it, but hearing you say it, it sounds right to me.
So let's hear another poem. Donald Hall.
All right.
At the Library of Congress.
I'll read one of the Jane poems since we've been speaking of that. This is a poem called Weeds and Peonies, and actually it's the first poem I began after Jane's death, probably 2 or 3 weeks after her death I began it, before I wrote the letters to her. Weeds and Peonies. She was a great gardener, as this makes clear. Your peonies burst out, white as snow squalls, with red flecks at their shaggy centers, in your border of prodigies by the porch. I carry one magnanimous blossom indoors and float it in a glass bowl, as you used to do. Ordinary pleasures, contentment recollected, blow like snow into the abandoned garden, overcoming the daisies. Your blue coat vanishes down pond road into imagined snowflakes, with Gus at your side, his great tail swinging. But you will not reappear, tired and satisfied, and grief's repeated particles suffuse the air. like the dog yipping through the entire night, or the cat stretching awake, then curling as if to dream of her mother's milky nipples. A raccoon dislodged a geranium from its pot. Flowers, roots, and dirt lay upended in the back garden where lilies begin their daily excursions above stone walls in the season of old roses. I paced beside weeds and snowy peonies, staring at Mount Kearsarge, where you climbed wearing purple hiking boots. Hurry back. Be careful climbing down. Your peonies lean their vast heads westward as if they might topple. Some topple.
At the Library of Congress with Donald Hall, I'm Grace Cavalieri. He has written 19 books of poetry. Everyone says 15, but Donald, I count a 19.
I think 19 is more like it.
I do too. And 20 books of prose, collections of essays about poetry and baseball, and children's books, 11 books for children. And the one I have, The Oxcart Man, had the great privilege of winning the Caldecott Medal for the illustrations. And it started with a wonderful poem of your own, The Oxcart Man.
I'd like to read that if you'd
Let's
like to
get
hear
there.
It.
Because that sums up the history of New Hampshire.
Oxcart Man. In October of the year, he counts potatoes dug from the brown field, counting the seed, counting the cellar's portion out, and bags the rest on the cart's floor. He packs wool sheared in April, honey in combs, linen, leather tanned from deer hide, and vinegar in a barrel hooped by hand at the forger's fire. He walks by his ox's head 10 days to Portsmouth Market and sells potatoes and the bag that carried potatoes, flaxseed, birch brooms, maple sugar, goose feathers, yarn. When the cart is empty, he sells the cart. When the cart is sold, he sells the ox, harness and yoke, and walks home, his pockets heavy with the year's coin for salt and taxes, and at home by fire's light in November cold, stitches new harness for next year's ox in the barn, and carves a yoke, and saws planks, building a cart again.
Donald Hall, that poem, just imagine it now on several pages with these amazing folkloric illustrations, so colorful. I think there's another children's book in you, and I think it's the story about the snow so high the oxen got his foot stuck in the chimney. Wouldn't that be good?
That's a tall tale told by the cousins.
Needs to be in print.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe I can.
The 12th book, right here, born right here in front of us, as if by magic.
Well, thank you.
Donald Hall, I'm Grace Cavalieri. He has mastered every form of writing. He has lived by his wits. Do you remember who you said that about?
Edwin and Willow Muir.
Yep, lived by his wits, and you have lived by your pen. Donald, I do not know any poets except Franz Wright, son of your friend James Wright,
yes,
who might be living like you do.
Yes.
Who? When you look at Robert Bly, he teaches poetry workshops and makes a living really teaching.
Well, not at colleges.
No, not at colleges.
Special occasions.
He doesn't live by his wits only. And look at Ashbery. I mean, he's at the New School.
Yeah.
But, I mean, who is not really affiliated with a college? That is...
I was for some years, of course.
Of course.
But 30-odd years ago, I quit.
You gave up tenure.
Giving up tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And moved to the farm to write all day. It was terrifying, but it was absolutely the best thing I ever did. Beside marrying Jane in the first place. She was urging the move to the farm. She wanted to get out of the academic world and live by ourselves in the country and write all day. And that's just what we did.
Yes, you did. And it's here to prove it, too. And all of your essays, not only your editing, your essays, your prose, biographies, memoirs, textbooks, journalism, interviews... Let's give a kiss to the University of Michigan Press. I think those guys are great, don't you? Look at these books.
Yes, so
you
many
did
of
that.
Them. So many of
you
them.
You started all that, Donald.
Yes,
Poets
I did.
On Poetry.
A series of books collecting the words of poets on poetry. Many of them interviews.
You started so many projects there. How did you do that?
I wasn't teaching. I wasn't going to cocktail parties or dinner parties. I was staying home in New Hampshire, working while Jane worked.
But isn't there something about being on the ground floor in life at the inception of the universe when the Paris Review started, when the University of Michigan was just getting its breath? You really saw what things could become. And like Allen Ginsberg says, every time there's a crevice, stick something in it.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I found I had a lot of ideas and followed them all up. It was a busy life, but I enjoyed it enormously.
It is still a busy life, and you're still enjoying it. You're going to write the ox with his leg in the chimney.
All right, I have my assignment.
I'm so glad. I love to boss people around. Donald Hall, Grace Cavalieri, together at the Library of Congress. And I have been reading him since the 50s, and now I'm sitting with him. So let's have another poem.
All right. Let's have one called Names of Horses. New Hampshire is one of my subjects, and this is one of my New Hampshire poems. I used to come up to New Hampshire in the summer with my grandparents, the house where I'm living now, which was my great-grandparents to begin with. And I would work on poems in the morning, but in the afternoon I would go haying with my grandfather. And it was a farm which consisted of one old man and one horse, one old horse, for all their work. But I helped him in the summer. Names of Horses. All winter your brute shoulders strained against collars, padding and steer-hide over the ash hames, to haul sledges of cordwood for drying through spring and summer, for the Glenwood stove next winter, and for the simmering range. In April you pulled cartloads of manure to spread on the fields, dark manure of Holsteins, and knobs of your own clustered with oats. All summer you mowed the grass in meadow and hayfield, the mowing machine clacketing beside you while the sun walked high in the morning. And after noon's heat, you pulled a clawed rake through the same acres, gathering stacks, and dragged the wagon from stack to stack, and the built hay rack back uphill to the chaffy barn, three loads of hay a day hanging wide from the hay rack. Sundays you trotted the 2 miles to church with the light load of a leather quarter-top buggy and grazed in the sound of hymns. Generation on generation, your neck rubbed the windowsill of the stall, smoothing the wood as the sea smooths glass. When you were old and lame, when your shoulders hurt bending to graze, one October the man who fed you and kept you and harnessed you every morning led you through corn stubble to sandy ground above Eagle Pond and dug a hole beside you where you stood shuddering in your skin and laid the shotgun muzzle in the boneless hollow behind your ear and fired the slug into your brain and felled you into your grave, shoveling sand to cover you, setting goldenrod upright above you, whereby next summer a dent in the ground made your monument. For 150 years in the pasture of dead horses, roots of pine trees pushed through the pale curves of your ribs. Yellow blossoms flourished above you in autumn, and in winter frost heaved your bones in the ground. Old toilers, soil makers, oh, Roger, Mackerel, Riley, Ned, Nellie, Chester, Lady Ghost.
Nothing more beautiful than the naming of things.
I didn't begin it that way. That was a late thought.
You mean you thought of ending it with those names? And then you titled the poem that.
Yes.
I was looking at the consistency of the stanzas and saying to myself that you always are dependable about your line lengths and your presentation. And you've always sort of taught that. You've said, you know, you can't just drop words on a page.
Yeah.
And just have them sprinkled all over the place.
You have to set them.
Yeah.
And you set them with their music in mind.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're talking to Donald Hall, who is the Poet Laureate of the United States. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back. Talking about form, if you were to compress what you think it is, and you've talked about it a lot in essays, and recently, I think American Poetry Review last year had also a remark or two by you.
Yeah.
You say, you know, line of sight, where you want to see it on the page shows us how to read it on the page.
That's right. It's a kind of musical notation, where you break the lines and where you put the spaces.
It's sort of a braille for readers.
Yeah.
And we just can't throw the words across the room. But other than that, you don't get too pedantic. You say, you know, you talk about unity and symmetry, and I think some call that form.
Yes, unity, conclusiveness, bringing a poem together at the end.
Mm.
When you're writing a sonnet, you know a lot about the 140th line when you begin it. When you're writing free verse, you don't. You have to make it up and find it for yourself each time. I've got one little poem that I've used to show that. It's a little New Hampshire poem called Mount Kearsarge. Great blue mountain, ghost, I look at you from the porch of the farmhouse where I watched you all summer as a boy. Steep sides, narrow flat patch on top, you are clear to me, like the memory of one day. Blue, blue, the top of the mountain floats in haze. I will not rock on this porch when I am old. I turned my back on you, Kearsarge. I close my eyes, and you rise inside me, blue ghost.
I'm crazy for your vowels.
Well, so am I.
Obviously.
I ended the poem Blue Ghost, and the first line is Great Blue Mountain Ghost. Words 2 and 4 make the final 2 words. And when I wrote it, I didn't know I was doing that. But that is part of the coherence. And elsewhere as well, I remember changing the lines at the very end, changing the way I broke them, so that they go, I close my eyes and you rise inside me, blue ghost. So they end, oh, I, ooh, oh.
Eyes rise, oh, oh.
Long vowels, I love them.
Oh, man, you got it to give. Donald Hall. I'm Grace Cavalieri. He's won many, many awards, was a recipient of 2 Guggenheims, and was Poet Laureate of New Hampshire. Robert Frost Medal. Did you read that there was a new Robert Frost poem just discovered? That had
yes.
Never.
Yeah,
yes. By a graduate student.
Yes.
I finally found a reason for graduate students.
And the Harvard University Press is bringing out his notebooks soon, which I look forward to enormously.
But at least we knew of those. But this poem had never been seen before.
Yes.
I think that's astonishing. Do you think we'll have a Donald Hall poem that has never been seen before that's in your underwear drawer?
There are plenty of them around.
Mm-hmm. That has never, that have not
that
been.
That don't deserve being seen.
They don't have coherence.
In my opinion. No.
Well, give them some coherence.
I'll work on it.
I love being here with you. I'm Grace Cavalieri. He has won the Edna St. Vincent Millay Award, a much underserved poet whom I loved when I was 16, Edna St. Vincent Millay, the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Ruth Lilly Prize, the NBCC Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Poetry, nominated for the National Book Award. Never, never lunging toward fame, ever. Donald Hall never lunged toward fame. He just sat there and wrote 60 years and let something fall down on him.
The pleasure is in the writing, you know. It's not in the publishing or in what happens afterwards. I mean, I don't mean to say I'm above it all. I'm pleased when those nice things happen. But it's the daily work, the struggle with language, that is the real reward.
The wish to keep going.
Yep.
The wish to keep doing it again, just to give me one more poem. That's what it's about. But don't you think the awards help to give you reason to go on?
Yes, I do. They're encouraging.
Yeah, they're encouraging. I like that.
Definitely.
Let's have another poem.
Okay.
We're at the Library of Congress.
Here's a little tiny one that I like to read sometimes. It's called The Poem.
Mm-hmm.
It discovers by night what the day hid from it. Sometimes it turns itself into an animal. In summer, it takes long walks by itself where meadows fold back from ditches. Once it stood still in a quiet row of machines. Who knows what it is thinking?
That's the beauty of it, right?
Yes.
It might even be thinking something you're not thinking.
Again and again it is in the poems that I write and that I eventually like. I started out saying something I had no idea I was saying.
Look what I said. No, it's look what I know. I mean, you only know what you wrote, really? I mean, you only know in this life. When you go back here, you think, oh, that's all I really know.
Yes, I suppose it is.
Your poems are crafted. Your essays, do you think that you... I know you spend a lot of time on revisions, but do you think when you write an essay that it is quite as laborious or as worked over? Or
no.
Is it easier?
It's easier. Yeah. It doesn't take so many times, so many revisions. A poem typically takes at least 50, and often it goes up to 100. But an essay, then they're not easy. I mean, I remember writing them years ago when I could do them in 4 drafts, but I'm not so glib now. And nowadays it takes me frequently 20 drafts or so.
Maybe nobody would notice if you stopped after 4.
Maybe not, but I do.
I understand. The essay, you say someplace that you finally learned to do, change your which to that's and your that's to which.
Yes.
So you have learned something along the way. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress with the new, brand new Poet Laureate of the United States of America. Man, bring up the stars. That is like quite a moniker. And it means that you will choose 2 Witterbinner Fellows.
Yes.
And I hope, and I will get to meet them, of course. Do you know when you might be doing that? Will it be this spring or something?
I don't really know. Okay.
Spring's good.
Good.
But you'll be doing other things. You are hosting some poets, and would you name a couple of from the new season? I think Maxine is coming down.
Maxine is coming, Liam Rector. Galway Canal, and several others.
Judith Harris, yeah. Do you know Henri Cole?
Yes, I know Henri Cole, mm-hmm. And in fact, he's coming also.
It's going to be a very nice fall in Washington.
Good.
And you're going to be there. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're talking to Donald Hall about his life and his work and his teachings. And I remember when he first came out with a book, an anthology, with Robert Pack and Lewis Simpson, and it was called The New Poets of England and America. Now, I think that was like your first anthology.
It was the first anthology, yes.
And since then, how many, I wonder?
Well, the general anthology, just a couple more. There was a second volume of that anthology, and then there was one I did alone for Penguin called Contemporary American Poems.
You know, I'm setting the record straight, but they don't ever put The Dark Houses up there with your books from 1955.
Really? It's my second book of poems.
Okay. But it never gets on the list.
That's strange.
We'll check it out. Okay. Yeah. Donald Hall, let's have another poem.
Yes. This one is called Tubes. And it consists of a lot of speeches by one man who is in on his deathbed, clearly, from the way he's being treated. And I do know that, in fact, he would not feel so eloquent. But I pursued the fiction of an eloquent voice under these circumstances. Tubes. Up, down, good, bad, said the man with the tubes up his nose. There's lots of variety. However, notions of balance between extremes of fortune are stupid, or at best unobservant. He watched as the nurse fed pellets into the green nozzle that stuck from his side. Mmm, said the man, good, mmm. Next time more basil. When a long-desired baby is born, what joy! More happiness than we find in sex, more than we take in success, revenge, or wealth. But should the same infant die, would you measure the horror on the same rule? Grief weighs down the seesaw. Joy cannot budge it. When I was 19, I told a 30-year-old man what a fool I had been when I was 17. We were always, he said, glancing down, a fool 2 years ago. The man with the tubes up his nostrils spoke carefully. I don't regret what I did, but that I claimed I did the opposite. If I was faithless or treacherous and cowardly, I had my reasons, but I regret that I called myself loyal, brave, and honorable. Of all illusions, said the man with the tubes up his nostrils, IVs, catheter, and feeding nozzle, the silliest one was hardest to lose. For years, I suppose, that after climbing exhaustedly up with pitons and ropes, I would arrive at last on the plateau of walking level forever among moss with red blossoms. But of course, a continual climbing is the one form of arrival we ever come to, unless we suppose that the wished-for height and house of desire is tubes up the nose.
That always made me uncomfortable, that poem.
Yes, I suppose it's supposed to.
I know, you do that. But it says what has to be said. I just, for some reason, that was the one poem that physically I respond to in my body. I guess we don't like the tubes.
Yeah.
Donald Hall and Grace Cavalieri are back together again for the first time. It's a new first at the Library of Congress with the Poet Laureate of the United States. And we've been reading him for many years. I have not read your plays yet, Donald.
Maybe they're not worth reading.
I don't know if you know that.
No, but
really?
I've worked a bit in the theater, and I really haven't been very pleased with the result.
Did you see them produced?
Yes.
And can you tell me what disappointed you or what you hoped for?
I think that they had the prose writer or poet's typical problem of depending on speech and perhaps even on long speeches overmuch.
Oh.
Not enough on stage business and things that you can show with action.
That's interesting. Yeah, there is a difference between dramatic literature and the play.
Right.
The play and the spectacle, you know. But I think that's very insightful of you to say, because most poets just lambaste the nature of American theater if their play is not successful. But that is a problem that can be overcome if you were interested in looking at your plays again.
Perhaps. Right now I'm not looking at them.
You're not really interested.
No.
You have to get in the sandbox in the theater, really, when you've got a play on.
Yeah. I loved getting in the sandbox. I loved working with actors and a director and making changes during rehearsal. I drove people nuts that way. But the results were not really satisfactory.
What theater was it in?
Oh, there have been a couple of plays. I did a play back in Ann Arbor about the wobbly movement, the IWW. That one actually worked visually better than most, but it was able to work visually because it had an enormous cast using students who did not belong to Equity or get Equity money. There was only one Equity player in the show. And I think it was mounted with great skill by the producer, who also allowed me to do things like freezing the motion on one part of the stage and continuing on another. But it could not have a life because you can't get anywhere with a cast of 50. You can't mount commercial theater.
You are absolutely right. However, don't tell Eugene O'Neill that. You know, don't tell the great playwrights that if you cannot get a play on with more than 7 characters in New York, Donald. Literally,
no.
I'm telling you, 7. No. You will be told to take away 2 characters.
Yeah.
It can't be more than 7. So you had 43 left over.
Yeah.
But don't tell playwrights that what they can't write. That really makes me really crazy, that to think Eugene O'Neill would be told that he could only have 7 characters or something.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. What was the other? What was the other play? There were three.
Another play was based on "String Too Short to Be Saved," a book without much dialogue and without much conflict in it, which made it interesting. But I was able to put it into just a few characters and put it on the stage. But it depended too much on long speeches and on language in general and the action. In the book and in the, on the stage was limited.
Well, I understand, but the Irish are now bringing that into New York, and they're standing there and looking at the audience and giving monologues.
Yeah.
And it's so, you know, you might just be in style any minute.
Well, I could try it again.
You could. They're published?
No, they're not published.
They're not published. That maybe that's a good
but
thing
that,
to do.
The second one, the string play, which I called The Bone Ring mostly, has had several different productions.
I'd love to. That one interests me. That one interests me. It sounds like Beckett. What is the third play?
I guess there's no third play.
There
that
was three plays on my research.
I can't.
Well, maybe it's the one you're writing on the way back.
Maybe.
Donald Hall. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're here celebrating, and we'll hear more poetry.
After Jane died, I wrote many poems of grief. For the first year, I wrote her letters. Later, I wrote some poems in rhyme and meter. I had written poems in rhyme and meter when I was young, but most of my life I've written varieties of free verse. But here is another one about her garden, called, in fact, Her Garden. I let her garden go, let it go, let it go. How can I watch the hummingbird hover to sip with its beak's tip the purple bee balm, whirring as we heard it years ago. The weeds rise rank and thick, let it go, let it go. Where annuals grew and burdock grows, where standing she at once could see the peony, the lily, and the rose, rise over brick she'd laid in patterns. Moss, let it go, let it go. Turns the bricks green, softening them by the gray rocks where hollyhocks that lofted while she lived, stem by tall stem, blossom with loss.
That recitative does it, doesn't it?
Yes, a little refrain, let it go, let it go. I know whose poetry in particular was behind these poems, Thomas Hardy, who wrote...
Who had a first marriage
which ended in his wife's death, but whose marriage was very dissimilar to Jane's and mine. But he wrote genuine and deeply moving poems of grief.
I have found a piece of paper that says some titles you haven't mentioned. One is Ragged Mountain Elegies.
Oh, that's another title for The Bone Ring.
Oh, that's the one I was thinking about. Okay.
Yeah.
Now that solves that problem. And is there another title for Bread and Roses?
No, that was the only title.
And Evening's Frost?
Oh, An Evening's Frost I put on. Yes, that's true. I was forgetting that. That was a portrait of Robert Frost. That worked pretty well. It was not long after his death, and it played for 4 months in New York at the Theatre de Delice, which is now the Lucille Hotel. And... then a subway strike happened and took it down. It was living by hand and mouth, just about making do with every week. But a year later, it went on the road to play at colleges, and it was a little biography of Robert Frost.
That's wonderful.
It would be dated right now. I mean, there are references to Frost reading at the Kennedy inaugural and so on, which everybody knew at the time, but they wouldn't know now.
Do you think they don't remember?
I think many people have never heard about it.
Boy, that really shocks me. Because that's the only good thing that's happened in history for a long time. And we forgot that?
Yeah.
Oh, hell, what a metaphor. Donald Hall is here illuminating the stage, illuminating my life for just 1 hour. And I hate to come together because then we have to say goodbye. But not yet. Let's have another poem.
Here's another one of the metrical poems that I wrote after Jane's death. It's called Summer Kitchen. In June's high light, she stood at the sink with a glass of wine and listened for the bobolink and crushed garlic in late sunshine. I watched her cooking from my chair. She pressed her lips together, reached for kitchenware, and tasted sauce from her fingertips. "It's ready now. Come on," she said. "You light the candle." We ate and talked and went to bed and slept. It was a miracle.
That is the bedrock for the poem, No Garlic Without Garlic.
Yeah.
When you end without garlic.
Yes.
It's nice. That's the historicity. All of those poems are all the same thing, without
yes.
garlic. The thing about having a poet for a husband, I have to say, is very nice, because my husband looks at me looking out of a January window and doesn't, he sees me doing this, but he doesn't say, "I see her looking out the January window." So that it's as if husbands do notice wives, and sometimes favorably. But the fact that you notice every gesture she made and how she walked striding with her hands in her jeans pockets and all of those noticing things that wind up in the poems, you know, it's very lucky to have a poet for a husband.
I was lucky to have a poet for a wife.
Oh, boy, wasn't she hot, though.
She was marvelous.
She was. I teach her otherwise.
Yes.
I teach her poetry. She was yeah. really something.
She was amazing.
Amazing, yes. And she's glad to be included today.
She is. I get boxes of anthologies with her in it all the time. She's constantly in anthologies. Anthologies of poetry or anthologies of that are thematic. Jane is always in them.
This is true. She's a major American woman poet, a preeminent
yep.
woman poet.
Who died at 47.
And will remain, though, in
yes.
history forever, yes. And she even, I even prayed to her this morning, and she got me a parking meter.
Very good.
Yeah, she's still...
I didn't know that she was interceding in the world that way.
Well, she's on the job. You know, she made this happen, I'm sure. Well, you have a poem which says, "You by now you know if you have a consciousness or if the soul
yes,
exists."
Yes, that's one of the letters.
Yes, and you know that it does. I'd love to hear another poem. Donald Hall is our Poet Laureate of the United States. He brings a great illuminating heart and the illumination of human relationships to this world in a time where it's broken without it.
Here's a poem called Affirmation. To grow old is to lose everything. Aging, everybody knows it. Even when we are young, we glimpse it sometimes and nod our heads when a grandfather dies. Then we rove for years on the midsummer pond, ignorant and content. But a marriage that began without harm scatters into debris on the shore, and a friend from school drops cold on a rocky strand. If a new love carries us past middle age, our wife will die at her strongest and most beautiful. New women come and go, all go. The pretty lover who announces that she is temporary is temporary. The bold woman, middle-aged against our old age, sinks under an anxiety she cannot withstand. Another friend of decades estranges himself in words that pollute 30 years. Let us stifle under mud at the pond's edge and affirm that it is fitting and delicious to lose everything.
If we lose loss, what will we have left?
Yes.
How big was the pond?
The pond is 40 acres of water.
Oh, really? I don't think I've seen it written anywhere. 40
no.
acres of water. 40
yeah.
acres of water.
Yeah.
That's big.
It would be a lake most places.
Yes, it would.
But New Hampshire understatement makes it a pond.
I love that. New Hampshire understatement. Yes, let's not shout. Your poems never shout. You get mad sometimes, but you never raise your voice, which I think is... The way we maintain power is to lower our voice when we have something important to say.
Yes.
May we hear another?
I'll read a poem from the time of Jane's illness. This is called The Ship Pounding. Each morning I made my way among gangways, elevators, and nurses' pods to Jane's room to interrogate the grave helpers who tended her through the night, while the ship's massive engines kept its propellers turning. Week after week, I sat by her bed with black coffee and a globe. The passengers on this voyage wore masks or cannulae, or dangled devices that dripped chemicals into their wrists. I believed that the ship traveled to a harbor of breakfast, work, and love. I wrote, when the infusions are infused entirely, bone marrow restored and lymphoblasts remitted, I will take my wife, bald as Michael Jordan, back to our dog and day. Today, months later at home, these words turned up on my desk as I listened in case Jane called for help or spoke in delirium, ready to make the agitated drive to emergency again for readmission to the huge vessel that heaved water month after month without leaving port, without moving a knot, without arrival or destination, its great engines pounding. Mm.
Mm. What would you like to read next? Do you like Secrets?
Yes, I do like Secrets.
I like that too.
Let me read that.
Because my CD cut off right at the place in that poem where if I call, you'll unplug the phone.
And really?
Yes, so I thought it was very mystical. And that's why I want to hear it out loud.
Secrets. You climbed Hawk's Crag, a cell phone in your baggy shorts, and gazed into the leafing trees and famous blue water. You telephoned in love with the skin of the world. I heard you puff as you started to climb down, still talking, switching your phone from hand to hand as the stone holds required. You sang show tunes sitting above me, clicking your fingers, swaying your shadowy torso. We attended to each other in a sensuous dazzle as global as suffering, until gradual gathering spilled like water over the stone dam, and we soared level over the long-lived lake. But how can one flesh and consciousness adhere to another, knowing that every adherence ends in separation? I long for your return, your face lit by a candle, your smile private as a Cory's under an inconstant flame, and dreamt I stared into the flat and black of water, afraid to drown. It is half a year since we slept beside each other all night. I wake hollow as a thigh bone with its marrow picked out. In falling snow, a crow pecks under the empty bird feeder. When the house lights go out in wind and heavy snow, the afternoon already black, I lie frightened in darkness on the unsheeted bed. No one comes to my door. Old age concludes in making wills and trusts and inventories in knees that buckle going downstairs. Wretched in airless solitude, I want to call you. But if you hear my voice, you will unplug your telephone and lie awake until morning. I remember you striding toward me, hands in jean pockets, each step decisive, smiling as if you knew that the cool air kept a secret but might be cajoled into revealing it.
That is beyond what a human being can write. Hollow as a thigh bone. Oh, man. That is beyond what someone can write.
Well,
how did you,
you
ever write that? What gets me is the bed without the sheets.
Yeah.
That's the image, isn't it?
And she's in bed.
Unsheeted bed. How did you get the energy to write that? How did you get the energy to
It took me a couple of years to write it, and I worked at it not every day, but frequently. And it was a different poem with different parts and maybe 5 or 6 pages long at some point. And I made the unsheeted bed as one of the later changes, actually, as I recall.
That's a perfect image. It wouldn't be the same without it.
Good.
Yeah. That takes my breath away. And we can have another. I have enough breath for one more.
Okay. One more poem I'll read. It's called North-South. Morning is a dog with failing hindquarters. It can no longer chase the thrown stick. Crossing the avenue in Seattle, I step in front of a bus and leap clear. In Boston, I stare into the blazing warehouse, eager for fire, terrified to burn. You are alive when you love someone and lie with her making the spoons. You are alive when dead love cuts the cords behind your knees. Nuthatches and chickadees eat cells of black oil sunflower seed, swapping their perches, gorging their stomachs full. I feel hunger for their hunger, for the appetite so swiftly satisfied of little ones. This morning the cat stretches awake, yawning after a dream of sparrows. Sky clears into sky, clouds scudding, mountain lofty in morning light. I enter again the province of words, domain without clocks or despair.
That is Donald Hall. He has never ignored the beauties around him, even the terrible beauties. Never have you ignored one thing around you. Not the sights, not the feelings, not the grief. That's a wonderful thing to have not ignored it.
Well, thank you.
A wonderful thing.
Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to be with you. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We've been talking and listening to the voice of Donald Hall. He's the 14th Poet Laureate of the United States. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. You can hear these programs on www.loc.gov/poetry. The series is brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. I'm Grace Cavalieri.